Welcome back to the program. Winston Churchill once said of Russia that it was a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. Much the same might be said of the federal government's most secret and largest land parcel in the United States. Almost the size of the state of Connecticut, Area 51 represents the apotheosis of the military-industrial complex in the U.S. Our guest this morning, Annie Jacobson, has written the first book to really look inside and make this link between the military and espionage in our nation's history. We're going to talk about it this morning. Annie Jacobson is a contributing editor at the Los Angeles Times Magazine. She's an investigative reporter whose work has appeared in numerous publications, including the National Review and the Dallas Morning News. It is my pleasure to welcome Annie Jacobson here to talk about her new book, Area 51, The Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. Annie, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Talk a little bit about how you started to really gather information about something that has traditionally been so secret to the point of utter denial at times by the U.S. government.
Well, I was at a Christmas Eve dinner in 2007, and a then 88-year-old physicist named Edward Lovick leaned over to me and said, "Boy, have I got a story for you." I hear that a lot as a national security reporter, but what Lovick said was really stunning. He was the man who invented stealth technology for the CIA going back to when Eisenhower was president. And the reason that he could disclose this to me in 2007 and not before was because the CIA had just declassified a large treasure trove of documents about an airplane that had been built out at Area 51 called the A-12 Oxcart. It was a stealth spy plane that in the early 1960s could travel Mach 3, which is actually a little over Mach 3, which is more than 2,300 miles per hour. It could get from Area 51 in Nevada to Washington, D.C. in a little over 60 minutes.
And as you started to dig into this and get more and more information, and one person led you to another, talk a little bit about your own views and how your surprise and your sense of this place started to evolve.
Well, it's interesting to keep in mind that Area 51 it's a smaller parcel of land set inside that bigger parcel that you referenced in your intro.
Right.
And that is that parcel that is about the size of the state of Connecticut, and it is called the Nevada Test and Training Range. That's where the Department of Defense, the CIA, the formerly Atomic Energy Commission, now Department of Energy, and a number of other agencies from NASA, the NSA, NRO, all sort of meet and merge out there in the desert 75 miles north of Las Vegas. Inside of that is Area 51 and also something called the Nevada Test Site, which is also divided up into quadrants, Area 1, so on, up to about Area 30. And the Nevada Test Site is where, beginning in 1951, under the authorization of President Truman, America set off over 100 atmospheric nuclear bombs. So we're talking mushroom cloud and all. And when I found that out, it really piqued my attention for two reasons. One, because Area 51 is such a public idea. It's such a public myth today. And yet very little is ever made of its nuclear history. And that intrigued me for two reasons. One, because certainly anything that goes on with nuclear weapons is going to be top secret. All people who work with nuclear weapons have to have a special top secret security clearance that's called a Q clearance. And then the fact that this was kind of whitewashed out of the lore of Area 51, as an investigative reporter, I really wanted to know what was going on with that.
And in fact, one of the things you talk about, the nuclear explosions there, at one point, I think it was 1957, there was a nuclear test there that was so large it actually closed down Area 51 for a while.
That's right. And the way that I report the book is I interviewed 74 men with direct, rare access to the base, 32 of whom lived and worked there for extended periods of time. And I really believe that great history comes from men's biographies, people who were actually there, eyewitnesses to history. And so I tell the different stories through the eyes of the different men who were actually there. And that bomb you just spoke of, its code name was Hood. It was more than five times the size of the Hiroshima bomb, if you can believe it. 74 kilotons. exploded right there, about, you know, a stone's throw from Area 51 in an area called Area 10. And Richard Mingus was the security guard on that test. He was actually at the control point when the bomb went off, and his supervisor looked at him and said, "Oh my God, the gate to Area 51 has been left unsecured," sending Mingus driving across the landscape through the fallout of this mushroom cloud just about 45 minutes or an hour after it exploded, dodging these giant boulders in his AEC truck, with the hills in the background on fire and the jacaranda bushes in flames, so that Mingus could get to this guard gate at Area 51, where everyone had already been removed. But yet, there was that idea of, my goodness, what if someone goes there? This is already inside a federally secured area of land, so you can see the intense security at issue. And those are the kind of stories that I think are eye-opening and remarkable and really give you a window into this incredible slice of American history that has been unknown for 50 years.
And what's so interesting is how little we as Americans have known about it, but yet the Soviets had a fairly good idea of what was going on there from satellite imagery back in the early 1960s.
That's right. And Ed Lubick, who I mentioned earlier, was the lead physicist on this stealth plane in the late 50s. It was beginning to be built out there at Area 51, or rather beginning to be test flown. They needed to put a mock-up of the plane up on a giant radar testing pole out in the middle of this vast desert landscape and shoot radar at it to make sure that it was in fact stealthy, that it was in fact invisible to radar, because that was the whole goal, to be able to send it over the Soviet Union and the Soviet Union not to know that it was there. And Lovett tells these great stories of everyone on his team having the Soviet satellite schedules in their front pockets, because they needed to know, you know, a satellite takes about 90 minutes to circle the globe. And so this schedule let the scientists and the engineers and the workers know when the Soviet satellite would be overhead, intending to take photographs of what was going on at Area 51. And the whole team would have to quickly do their work inside of that 90-minute window of time and then hide the aircraft.
One of the things that seems to run throughout so much of what's happened out there in the larger property and also in Area 51 is this ongoing tension between the CIA and the Air Force. Talk about that.
Well, that's right, and it's fascinating because it's kind of a Cold War rivalry drama that is largely unknown. We certainly know about it in other aspects of different interfederal agencies, but the CIA-Air Force one is really unique because I think that the CIA very much got the short end of the stick because the CIA has to keep itself secret. But they, in fact, developed so much incredible science and technology out there in the desert. Keep in mind that Area 51 was set up specifically to push science and technology for military applications further and faster than any other nation in the world. And that's exactly what they did. The first spy plane out at Area 51 that the CIA came up with was the U-2. And, of course, this is very famously known because it's the airplane that Gary Francis Powers was shot down in flying over Russia and created a huge international incident. That was built by the CIA. It was done in an amazingly short time frame, very effectively. I interview some of the first pilots who were out at Area 51 flying this plane in 1955. The amazing thing about the U-2, it was designed to fly up at 70,000 feet, which is about 13 miles up. And the point of that was that Russian missiles couldn't get up that high. And so the pilots, a pilot named Ray Gowdy, who's now 92, told me this amazing story. He was the first man to get the plane up over 65,000 feet in the skies over Area 51. It was so high up there that from Nevada, he could look west and see the Pacific Ocean. So you have this amazing asset with wings. And then you have the Air Force kind of saying, wait a minute, we're the ones who should be controlling flying machines for the United States. And so a rivalry began with the U-2, with General LeMay, who was the head of SAC at the time, and Richard Bissell, who was in charge of the U-2 program for the CIA, and they became great rivals. Meanwhile, the Air Force got its own version of the U-2s, but the CIA U-2s were always a little bit better.
One of the other things one wonders about this is that with all of the nuclear testing that went on there, with this story you tell about this nuclear rocket that was allowed to overheat back in 1965, you come away with a sense that this place, given the half-life of all of this, is just a radioactive wasteland.
Well, that's true, yes and no, because, you know, as horrific as the atomic bombs that are exploded in the atmosphere are, and that they are, because the radiation disperses into the atmosphere. And eventually, by 1963, after 8 long years of protracted negotiations, there was a test ban treaty which prohibited exploding nuclear bombs in the atmosphere. But separate from that is what happens when there is a meltdown of a nuclear reactor, or when there's what in essence is now known as a dirty bomb. That is when plutonium can be spread across the landscape. And plutonium, as we know, has a half-life of 24,000 years. So you're absolutely right. That's what becomes a radioactive wasteland. And people, you know, it's an interesting distinction that most of us don't know, which is that there's a difference between atmospheric radiation and land contamination. And there are two parcels of land that are terribly contaminated out there in the desert. The one you referred to where we allowed this meltdown of the nuclear rocket, that's in Area 25. And that is now where the Department of Homeland Security conducts post-nuclear incident training activities, because it really is like a post-nuclear accident wasteland.
And then there was this incident in 57 with a dirty bomb.
Yes, and I also tell that story through the eyes of Richard Mingus, because he was the security guard out there. And that is stunning to me, that someone could stand guard on a plutonium dispersal test and not be infected by this. But plutonium, as I write in the book, is really a poison of paradox, meaning it does have a half-life of 24,000 years, but unless you ingest it, unless it gets into your blood, then it is, you can actually, the plutonium particles could, in essence, you know, touch your skin and brush off. But the dirty bomb test itself was interesting because it was the brainchild of the Department of Defense and the Atomic Energy Commission. And the idea behind it was, and this was in 1957, what would happen if an Air Force airplane carrying a thermonuclear weapon were to crash on American soil? The Department of Defense wanted to know, would that crashed bomb create its own mushroom cloud? Would it actually have a nuclear explosion? Or would something else happen, kind of like what we now today know as a dirty bomb? So the DOD teamed up with the Atomic Energy Commission. They found what they felt was a perfect parcel of land at Area 51, a little north of where the pilots were testing the U-2s. And they parceled off a little piece of land, and they did this test, a mock test. And in fact, the results were that 895 acres were contaminated by this plutonium, and they still are today, although the Department of Energy tried to clean it up in the 80s by scraping almost a foot of land off the top of this whole surface and burying it, you know, as nuclear waste. But still, according to my interview with the spokesman for the Weapons Agency today, it's actually still contaminated out there.
What was the impact of the end of the Cold War on Area 51?
Well, when the Berlin Wall came down, there was a sense that Area 51 had perhaps reached its end. The F-117 bomber had been in play there. That rivalry that you spoke of between the CIA and the Air Force, it was kind of the CIA working as eyes in the skies, and the Air Force, I sometimes see as like the swords in the skies, because most Air Force planes, almost all of them, in fact, have weapons. You know, they either they drop bombs or they shoot missiles. And that rivalry continued on until, in essence, the Air Force won. And the Air Force won by developing the F-117 stealth bomber out there, that famous arrowhead-shaped plane that became known in the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. And so as that wound down, there was a sense, perhaps, that Area 51 had reached its end. But that all changed with the War on Terror. And although everything that goes on at Area 51 now is classified top secret, and therefore I can only get speculation from people about what goes on there, the idea, the true sense, and certainly backed up by Google images, is that the base has built up to an extraordinary all-time high with many new runways and, you know, under constant construction and hangars as the CIA and the Air Force work together again, just like they did in the Cold War, but only now they're merging drones, they're merging this idea of overhead espionage with firing weapons.
And in fact, the size of Area 51, you say, has grown considerably since 9/11.
Yes. Well, the landscape of Area 51 kind of remains, its borders are murky, let's put it that way. But the actual base where you can see, you know, hangars and runways and radar facilities, that is getting more populated, so to speak.
There was one story that you tell that back prior to 9/11, as early as 2000, that the CIA and the Air Force worked together to build a kind of mock-up of what they thought Osama bin Laden's compound in Afghanistan might look like.
Which is a really interesting program, again, with the two services working together. Now, this is long before, certainly before 9/11, after bin Laden had been indicted for the two embassy bombings in Africa. So he was a most wanted man, and an idea came about to attach Hellfire missiles to this very unknown Predator drone. Of course, now the Predator is so widely known because it fights the war on terror, but at the time, the Predator was really a CIA espionage platform. It had flown a lot of missions during the Serbian-Bosnian War, and now the Air Force thought, well, what would happen if we put some Army missiles on that Predator drone? And they put together this engineering project out there where they married those two systems. And then they decided, well, there would be going to be a lot of collateral damage if we decide to assassinate this relatively unknown terrorist named Osama bin Laden. So we better figure out how much collateral damage would happen, because at the time, this is in the late 90s, bin Laden was known to do a lot of falcon hunting with members of Middle Eastern royal families, and it would have been a very bad idea if, you know, one of his guests had also been assassinated. So they did this test out there in the desert to see what would happen, and according to the sources, the test was successful, but it was never followed through because there were some legalities going on in the administration.
And all of the stories that have emerged over the years about UFOs and Area 51, talk about those stories and how all that we have been talking about relates to this mythology that has grown up.
Well, in examining Area 51, there are three formative cultural myths that are often associated with the base. There's, of course, the predominant one, which is UFOs and extraterrestrials are there, and that the government allegedly reverse engineers these spacecraft. The second biggest conspiracy theory that's attached to Area 51 is that the lunar landing was filmed and faked at Area 51. And the third biggest conspiracy theory put forth is that Area 51 is home to an underground tunnel system that connects with other military bases around the country. And people all over the web and elsewhere, you know, have ongoing dialogues about how this has to be true. Well, I found a little thread of truth in each of one, and I'll start with the underground tunnel system. In fact, there is a very complex system of tunnels, not at Area 51 that I learned, but next door at the Nevada test site, specifically in Area 12, Area 15, and in fact in Area 20, there's a tunnel system that's 4,500 feet down. That's almost a mile. And the point of those systems was, after that test ban, the nuclear test ban of 1963, nuclear weapons testing had to move underground because you were no longer allowed to explode atmospheric bombs. And so in these underground tunnels, dug 24/7 by hard rock miners, that is where the Department of Defense started to explode its nuclear weapons. So it's an interesting kind of truth about that legend. And then another one is the lunar landing conspiracy. Well, I interviewed Ernie Williams, a longtime Atomic Energy Commission employee, and he was the tour guide for the Apollo astronauts back in the late 60s and early 70s when the Apollo astronauts were sent to the Nevada test site next door to Area 51 because the craters that were made by these atomic explosions resemble the geology on the moon. And in the book, I have photographs of some of these the Apollo astronauts with mock-ups of lunar packs on their back crawling around these craters, even driving in a lunar vehicle on some of these craters. And so you can, again, see how that could really set off a firestorm of conspiratorial thinking. And then finally, the reverse engineering myth of flying saucers is very interesting because many of the engineers I interviewed worked on reverse engineering projects at Area 51, but the craft were not from outer space. They were usually from Russia. And the best example I can give, and I write about this at length in the book, was a Soviet MiG that was captured by the Israeli Mossad was borrowed by the CIA and reverse-engineered out at Area 51.
I know you've got to go, Andy, but real quickly, how much cooperation did you get ultimately from the government in terms of allowing you out there and allowing you to explore the area?
Well, as a journalist, you know, we don't really have to... We never have to run what we do by the government. So all of my sources spoke to me freely. Although it seems as if everything that I'm writing is top secret and classified, it's actually not. Like even the plutonium dispersal test, which seems so classified, that had been declassified 10 years ago. I just was able to locate the documents buried in the archive thanks to the source who told me about it. And at the end of the day, the Air Force and the CIA were both very cooperative in helping me publish photographs in my book, many of which have never been published before.
Annie Jacobson, the book is Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base, just out from Little Brown. Annie, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.